Great. Thank you, Kay. I'm going to set a little bit of an overall picture on codes of conduct and humanitarian principles which apply to our work, and many of you here will be familiar with this, but I think that it complements nicely what Charlie is going to talk about in terms of international humanitarian law. In terms of humanitarian principles and standards, a lot has emerged in the last 20 to 30 years to try to establish a common culture and a set of behaviors across NGOs, humanitarian organizations, international organizations, to guide our conduct based on common sets of humanitarian principles. Many of these principles have existed and been adopted by individual organizations long ago, but they've been codified in common codes of conduct in recent times. And as we'll see in a little while, many of them come into direct conflict with U.S. anti-terrorism laws and have, I'm sure, caused many of you headaches. I know they have caused me headaches in my past positions within the humanitarian community and have challenged our ability to live up to the humanitarian imperative. Essentially, humanitarian imperative is the notion that everyone has a right to humanitarian assistance and to be treated with dignity. Also, the right to offer it, which really comes into play when your NGO is trying to weigh these different legal constructs and codes. The other top-level common principle which most NGOs, the UN system, the Red Crescent movement have focused themselves upon is neutrality. Basically, that humanitarian agencies do not take sides in and on conflict or any types of hostilities or controversies which are based on political, racial, religious, ideological arguments. Impartiality is the other widespread common principle which many of our organizations have really adopted and built into their day-to-day work. The idea that aid is provided solely based on need. This very directly comes into conflict with U.S. anti-terrorism laws and with the idea of denying aid to a particular actor or party in a given situation. Where did all of this come from? Not to toot the horn of the International Red Cross and Red Crescent movement too much, but that is to a large degree where my background is. And as one of the oldest private networks of humanitarian organizations around the world, the International Red Cross and Red Crescent movement really got a head start on discussing and trying to come up with common humanitarian principles. And this has in large ways driven and impacted how other organizations, networks of organizations, have looked at key principles for guiding humanitarian action and for ensuring that they can continue to have access to those they need to serve and enjoy the confidence of all. The seven fundamental principles of the International Red Cross, Red Crescent movement were first adopted in a slightly different form, actually in 1921. And written into the International Committee of the Red Cross's statutes at that point in time. This was seen as a way of trying to coordinate and establish common culture across a growing number of national Red Cross, Red Crescent societies, the International Federation, and the ICRC, to ensure that standards of conduct and behavior were understood, and also to create an ethical framework in many ways for decision making within the Red Cross, Red Crescent movement about how, when, where they would act. Humanity, impartiality, neutrality, independence, voluntary service, unity, universality are the seven fundamental principles today. Interestingly, these fundamental principles were agreed not just by the Red Cross, Red Crescent societies, the ICRC, and the Federation, but in 1965 they were adopted by an international conference of the Red Cross, which states party to the Geneva Conventions participate in and have an active voice and vote. So all of those signatories to the Geneva Conventions agreed that these should be the fundamental principles guiding the actions and decisions of the International Red Cross Red Crescent movement as early as 1965. Again, they're largely, well, in many cases, especially around impartiality and neutrality and humanity, derived from aspects of the Geneva Conventions. Humanity is important, I think, in this debate because it talks very much about bringing assistance to those in need without discrimination. It talks about alleviating suffering based on need and a number of other aspects. But again, this principle seems to be ignored in terms of how NGOs and humanitarian organizations ought to conduct themselves vis-a-vis current legal regimes around anti-terrorism. Impartiality and neutrality, I think, are two of the other key fundamental principles of the Red Cross, Red Crescent movement, where we've felt conflict within the movement, especially the American Red Cross, where I worked for many years, because on the one hand, you have a domestic set of laws to which we have to comply or risk serious legal challenges. And on the other hand, our entire makeup, our entire personality as organizations and as part of the movement is supposed to be based on impartiality and neutrality. Neutral and impartial humanitarian action is very much the driving concept within the movement even to this day. And we debate amongst one another very much the lines we should and shouldn't cross to comply with domestic legislation and other pressures. Impartiality talks again about non-discrimination based on nationality, race, religious beliefs, class, or political opinions, relieving suffering based on needs, giving priority based on the most urgent needs. And neutrality talks about, in order to enjoy the confidence of all, not taking sides in those hostilities or engaging in controversies of political, racial, and other natures. I think one of the things which I found that the U.S. government had a hard time sometimes understanding is that by complying with national law, we were seen by our partners within the movement and our other partners on the ground as engaging in a political act. And essentially, we were seen as endorsing the very controversial and political views of the U.S. government in terms of who is and isn't a terrorist, what constitutes terrorism, and who deserves to receive assistance. The other big one, which is somewhat unique to the Red Cross and Red Crescent movement, is independence. And this is because Red Cross, Red Crescent societies are essentially auxiliary to the government and were formed as an outgrowth of their governments signing on to the Geneva Conventions. And as an auxiliary, you have a constant balancing act to do, and the American Red Cross is far from unique in that among other national societies, but certainly the current debate around anti-terrorism regulations and laws took this in a very complicated and more difficult direction in many ways. Proving that we were independent while asking partners to sign certifications saying that they would in no way provide material assistance to people on the SDM lists, or openly saying that we could not provide assistance in a given country due to economic sanctions that were in place, certainly caused others to believe that our independence had been undermined. And finding a way to balance those pressures and to make sure that we could come up with a legal justification for doing what we were mandated to do and what our own government and others had agreed we ought to do based on the fundamental principles long ago was a real challenge, especially post 9/11 and over the 6-7 years that I was still with the American Red Cross after that. To broaden those principles beyond the International Red Cross Red Crescent movement, the code of conduct for the movement in NGOs and disaster relief was developed in 1996, and I won't focus a lot on the details, but essentially the Steering Committee for Humanitarian Response and its member organizations decided that these same concepts should be applied clearly to situations of disaster relief and applied beyond just the Red Cross and Red Crescent movement to try to establish these norms and this culture across organizations, again, to safeguard our access and the confidence of those we serve. It has two basic parts. The code sets standards for the organizations providing disaster relief, but also makes recommendations to governments on the environment that they should be creating in order to make this possible. Again, it reinforces many of things which the Red Cross and Red Crescent movement have talked about for a long time, and which many of these individual organizations had enshrined in their own policies and standards. The humanitarian imperative comes first. It is given regardless of race, creed, nationality. And importantly, aid will not be used to further a particular political or religious standpoint. There are a number of other elements here which focus on professionalization, I think, across organizations and the industry, but those are the ones that jump out. In terms of what was recommended to governments, again, it was mentioned that governments should recognize and respect the independent, humanitarian, impartial actions of non-governmental humanitarian organizations. And for donor governments in particular, the second one here talks about providing funding with a guarantee of operational independence. Again, these were just recommendations, but they were certainly very strongly pointed out to governments in various different settings and agreed to across a variety of pretty diverse NGOs. One other place where, just to set the context, where you see a number of the same concepts coming up is the Sphere Project, and in particular its humanitarian charter. The commitment to act in accordance with the principles of humanity and impartiality is clear in the humanitarian charter. The code of conduct itself is actually very directly referenced, and fundamental principles in international human rights law are also referenced here as well. So you begin to see a body of policy that cuts across the humanitarian sector, which really motivates us to behave in a way where assistance is provided on the ground based on need alone, while at the same time we've, in the last decade especially, been challenged to act in a very different way by many of our main funding partners, as well as just to maintain legal compliance. I think I will stop there. I certainly can send around some of the additional details and a little bit on the particular conflicts that I've seen come up as a result of aspects of anti-terrorism laws. So let me turn it over to Charlie and talk more on the international legal front here.
Thank you.